Well, as it's the hour of 7 and our custom here is to start on time, we know you're busy people, welcome. Good evening and welcome to the second presentation in this our 14th season of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with help from our webmaster back there taking pictures, Haiwan Wan, and our research instruction coordinator, Brian Carson. Ryan Dowell and Patrick Peters designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shadden Melke. Our speaker tonight is a native of Charleston, West Virginia, and grew up in a small town outside the capital called Scott Depot, population 5,000. Growing up, he was a big fan of the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew and wanted to be a private investigator and often went around the neighborhood looking for cases to solve. At an early age, he developed a love of language and reading, and after hearing French one day on television, he became utterly captivated by the beauty of it and resolved that one day he would speak it fluently, and he has. He was influenced by a long line of teachers in the family, which extended back several generations, and by two teachers, Mrs. Shuda, his senior English teacher, and Mrs. Pitzer, his high school French teacher. Not surprisingly then, he went on to graduate with a degree in French and English at Marshall University in Huntington, West Virginia in 1992. Other degrees followed, a master's in French from the University of Kentucky in 1995, a master's in teaching from Marshall in 1997, a master's in library science from the University of Kentucky in 2000. He's presently a doctoral student in American Studies at the Universities of Angers in France. In 2001, he joined the WKU faculty in the Library Public Service Department, where he's an associate professor. In 2011, he was named the Academic Librarian of the Year by the Kentucky Library Association. His love for classic American films developed when he discovered Daniel Blum's pictorial history of silent film, and he's written about a number of stars from the Golden Age, including Susan Peters. His first book, published this year, is a biography of Covington native Una Merkel, the actress with sassy wit and southern charm. Merkel would appear in dozens of films after the 1930s and win a Tony on Broadway. A new mural was unveiled in her hometown just last month. Here to talk about her fascinating career, please welcome Sean Kinder. Sean.
Thank you, Brian, and I want to thank the Dean of Libraries, Connie Foster. She's not here, but she gave her regrets. But I want to thank Shadden and everyone else who helped make this possible, and I especially want to thank all of you who gave up your evening to learn more about Una Merkel, a good old Kentucky gal. So thank you so much for coming. As you can see, my title is Una Merkel, the actress with sassy wit and southern charm. And there, that's just a nice glamour shot of Una Merkel, who incidentally didn't feel like she was terribly attractive. But as you can see through subsequent photos in my presentation, she really was quite striking. All right, the first thing we need to talk about is how we pronounce her name. And it's pronounced Una, not Una. And I have an audio. Shen, if you could hit that, it'll appear at the bottom of the screen.
Did she know the name?
Yes.
she remembered that she had heard me. And I don't think it's that much different, but apparently it must be, because so many people have said the same thing. And in fact, I'm very grateful to be remembered over all these years, because I've been working over 44 years, and I haven't done very much the last year or two. And of course, people see things on the late show, I suppose, and some TV. But it's awfully nice to be remembered.
You're very well remembered. Is Una Merkel your real name?
It's pronounced Una.
Is it?
The soft Una. U.
But it was it the Miss O'Connor, wasn't it Una?
Hers was Una. But mine is Una.
Una.
You can
so I've been calling you Una for years.
Well, I like the soft U better. Yes.
All right. I just thought it was nice for you to hear her voice. This was taken from a radio interview that was broadcast by Richard Lamparsky. He had a very popular radio show in the 60s and 70s by the name of Whatever Became Of, where he would interview all these old stars of yesteryear. And I was actually very fortunate to interview Mr. Lamparsky for my book. He's still alive, alive and kicking in Southern California. And he gave me some really important information about Una's latter years. When you do a biography, the two most difficult areas of someone's life to explore and to research, of course, is their childhood and after they retire, because not much is written about those two time periods. But he was very instrumental in giving me a lot of really unheard of information about her retirement years. All right, as I mentioned before, Una was born in Covington, Kentucky in 1903. You can see where it is there, right across the river from Cincinnati. This is a family portrait. We're not exactly sure what the date is. We think Una might be around 5 years old there. Of course, that's her mother on the left and her father on the right. Her mother was Elizabeth Fairs, but she went by Bessie. And her father was Arno Merkel, and yes, Una Merkel is her real name. I say that because there are many websites that erroneously say that her name is Una Confelder, and that is categorically false. That's a mistake that someone uncovered through the census. They were looking at the wrong line of the census. She was actually living in their household, but she obviously is not a Confelder, so I'm always having to correct those. And I've done most of the Wikipedia article on her because I wanted that out. But and you'll learn a couple other things that are not true about Una Merkel that have been perpetuated over the years. And one is that Una Merkel is not her real name. It is indeed her real name. Her father was a third generation German-American. So she's, of course, fourth. And I get the question quite frequently, is Una related to Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany? She is not. That was Angela's married name and her first husband. I think Angela's on her second husband now, so there would be no relation to Angela, perhaps her first husband. Arno was an entrepreneur in the purest sense of the word. He always had a scheme going, not a negative connotation of that term, but he was a jack of all trades. He was always starting some new business venture. He spent most of his married life away from home, traveling abroad, and getting involved in various business ventures. Una spent most of her childhood traveling around the South with her family. Her father dabbled in, like I said, almost everything. He sold calendars, lifesavers. He was inventing things, he was patenting things, and you can find some of his patents online. And her education was very piecemeal until, as she pointed out, the age of 9, when the truant officer caught up with her. But her mother tried to instill a love of reading and read to her from the Bible every evening. But what her parents didn't know, and Una later reported, was when she said her prayers at night, the final part of her prayer was, "God, make my life exciting, even if it hurts me." And you will see from this presentation, I hope, that he granted her wish. They also try to instill in Una an appreciation of culture. So they would often take her to theatrical productions, and she would ask her father, "Papa, when's the shade going to go up?" That's what she called the curtain. And she would memorize portions of the plays, and she would later reenact them. And she would charge admission, which is just a pin, and woe be to you if you laughed at the wrong place or weren't paying attention, because she would storm off, very upset. But as she later laughingly said, that was the only time in my life where I really had any temperament, because Una was universally beloved. Everyone who worked with her always commented on what a wonderful person she was, how friendly, congenial, the ultimate professional. So she went out of her way to be very amicable to everybody. This gentleman here is named Clyde Day, and I interviewed Clyde Day in 2007. I started doing the research for the book in 2006, so this is very much near the beginning of my research. Clyde, at that point, lived just outside of Covington. He was 100 years old when this was taken, and he insisted that his 85-year-old wife drive me and a friend downtown to show me where Una used to live. He was sharp as a tack, very lucid, his memory was totally intact, and he was a fount of information. He did like to talk about other things than Una, and I had to steer him back to Una quite often. But this is in front of a house that she lived in, and there's no marker there. I'm sure the people who live there don't even know that a famous person once lived there. Her home place was torn down in 1972, but they were there for a while. And the reason he knew Una was that Una was best friends with his cousin Virginia Day. And he said he would often tag along and play with them. They played hide and seek there in the basement. And Una particularly liked Virginia's 70 dolls in her collection. He was invited to Una's 10th birthday party. And I asked him, "What did you bring?" He had no idea what he brought for her present. I asked him about Una's parents, and he said, "Oh, they were just average folks. They weren't from a theatrical family, as I mentioned, so they were very down to earth." And I'll show you another picture here before I tell you more about Clyde. I juxtaposed some pictures here. Right across the street was the Methodist church where Una attended. She did attend the Catholic church for a while, but she was encouraged to visit the Methodist church by Virginia and Clyde, and she became a member. She sang in the choir. And he remembers that on very pleasant summer evenings, they would stretch out on the grassy area in front of the church in the evening and have service, or maybe a little Bible study. He said she did sing in the choir. I asked him about her famous accent, and she's known, as my title of my book indicates, Southern Charm. She was known for her Southern accent. And he said, oh, she had it even then. He's like, and it wasn't affected. That was just a part of her. And that's something that people often comment on. She can modulate the accent at will. There are several films where you watch her and you don't hear an accent at all. So she could exaggerate it too when she needed to. All right. When you often read about Una, the name Lillian Gish comes up. And I need to debunk a couple things about Lillian Gish. They were indeed friends. They knew each other. But all through the internet, many, many sources, they say that Una was a stand-in for Lillian Gish in her famous film, Way Down East. And I never uncovered one shred of evidence to confirm that. In fact, in a Los Angeles Times article, Una said, "I was never Lillian Gish's understudy." So there you go. And I'm sure she would have spoken about Way Down East, because she did talk about being an extra on The White Rose, which is another one of D.W. Griffith's famous films. But she got to know Lillian Gish, and I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, because I need to tell you about Una's late childhood. She eventually left Covington, and they moved to Philadelphia, and she had expressed a desire to become an actress, so Arno moved into New York, so she could have more opportunities. And she enrolled in a very famous drama school. And she was walking home one day, and someone noticed her, and they said, "Wow, you you need to be in pictures. Because at the time, she wore a very striking resemblance to Lillian Gish. She had very long hair. This is later in their lives, and it's very hard to find pictures of Yuna before 1924. So I really didn't have an opportunity to show you a picture of her with long hair, but this is a little bit later. You can see that there's obviously a resemblance, but there was much more when they were younger. And this gentleman said, you know, you'd be perfect for a film that I'm producing. Why don't you come and read? Well, she did, and she got the part. And it was the part of the youngest sister in the family who was blind. But unfortunately, we cannot watch the film because it was never completed due to financial difficulties. But that's the one time where they worked together, and they actually cemented a very, very strong friendship. And I will tell you, and if I forget, remind me to tell you, about my conversation with Lillian Gish's manager. But Yuna Merkel also had some experience all throughout her young days in Covington. She was in almost every play that the school put on. And one person in the book was quoted as saying, is there a production that that Yuna Merkel kid is not in? So she did a lot, and she had elocution lessons, ballet lessons, from someone quite famous, Tyrone Power's mother. She walked across the bridge over to Cincinnati, and she was her teacher. She was also in the chorus of a Broadway production at the age of 12. There's not much written about that, but she was just in the chorus. So she, at this point, even though this is her first film, she had a lot of theatrical experience. Before she did this film, she went to one of D.W. Griffith's films, Broken Blossoms, I think. And she walked up to the box office with her grandfather, and this man jumped out and said, you look just like my dear Lillian. Has anyone ever told you that? And she's like, maybe once or twice, and they had a long conversation, and he said a couple more banalities and he left. Well, she was talking to D.W. Griffith but didn't know it until he had already left. So she was very excited. So by this point, she had already had quite a few acting experiences under her belt. She did silent films. I'm not going to talk too much about her silent films because none of them really exist. There is one experimental sound film that she did in 1924, and that does exist. But her silent film career was not going anywhere. So she turned her attention to the stage, and this is probably her first biggest hit. And this is a play called Pigs, not a very pleasant sounding name perhaps, but it was very popular with folks. It was about Yuna and her friend there, Wallace Ford, the actor Wallace Ford, who decided to adopt a litter of pigs so they wouldn't be taken to the slaughter. And that's really where she first got got some attention. The next play that really put her name on the map was Coquette. And this is an artist's rendering of what she looked like for Coquette. And I thought that was really charming. I wanted you to see it. This is a still that was taken of the production. On the right, you'll see Helen Hayes. And Yuna was delighted to be on the stage with Helen Hayes because she was an idol, just like Lillian Gish had been. On the left is Andrew Lawler. He was a child star, and he was rising up in the ranks in the theater. The Coquette was a smash hit. Yuna played a rather gawky, awkward Southern girl who wants to be more alluring to the opposite sex. And she could capitalize on her Southern accent, and she played it to the hilt, and the critics absolutely loved her. So much so that it had over a year performances, then she went on tour with it. And this is the play you've talked about. You probably remember God's Baby, the whole controversy about Helen Hayes. She was pregnant, she fainted one day, they had to stop the performance. The play ended. The producer did not want to pay the remaining cast members the rest of their time on the tour, so it went to court, and he had to pay. So it was kind of called, it's in the book, but it's God's Baby, and that was, God's Baby was Helen Hayes' daughter, Mary. Una remained very good friends with Helen Hayes, as she did Lil and Gish for the rest of her life. Andrew Lawler was Una's second love. Her first love kind of fizzled out very quickly because it was a fellow thespian. She tried it again with Andrew Lawler. And it was a very tragic story. I'm not going to go into all the details because I hope you'll read about it in my book. But needless to say, it's she realized that perhaps Andrew wasn't the right person for her. And before she could really reveal her true feelings, something tragic happened to Andrew. But they became close, obviously, during production. There's D.W. Griffith. And Una was really getting a lot of attention because of her performance on stage. And she did a test for D.W. Griffith. And he said, "Haven't I seen you somewhere before?" And she reminded him of the couple times they had met before. And he's like, "Well, I'm glad you're here to do a screen test." He's like, "Get in line. I've got some other people ahead of you, including Sylvia Sidney and a couple other people who went on to be famous." She sat there so long that she became hungry and she got a sandwich. And just about that time he came over and he said, "Okay, I'm ready for your screen test." She's like, "But I'm eating lunch." He's like, "That's fine." He's like, "That'll be perfect. It'll look natural." And she's like, "My eating like that?" And he's like, "Sure." So she did the screen test. And she was very unhappy with the screen test because she felt like she looked very unattractive, you know, chowing down on a sandwich. But he was rather noncommittal. He's like, "Well, you did a good job." He's like, I'll get back with you." But he didn't. But as time went on, her publicity from Coquette was such that he looked again at the screen test and was convinced, along with the heads of United Artists, that she would be perfect for Abraham Lincoln, D.W. Griffith's very first talkie. And she was invited to come to Hollywood. And she's like, "I don't want to go." He's like, "What do you mean?" Because he thought she was finagling for more money. She's like, "No, I'm happy in New York. My career's blossoming. I'm doing well. And, you know, I just don't really feel like I need to go to California." Well, they gave her more money, and she thought about it. She's like, "Well, my father's not in the best of health. He'd had an accident. He had broken his arm in several places." She thought, "Well, you know, California's a nice place. He could recuperate out there." So she went out there, and they actually signed her to a one-year contract. Her first film was Abraham Lincoln, although she did do another film that was released a couple weeks before Abraham Lincoln. She played Ann Rutledge, who was Abraham Lincoln's first love. Some people question that relationship, so historians are not quite in agreement about that. But D.W. Griffith was so impressed with Una before he hired her, he said, "You know, I'm going to give you the part of Ann Rutledge, but actually, I'd like for you to play Mary Lincoln as well." Of course, people really didn't do dual roles like that too much in those days, so she didn't get the dual role. But he was that impressed by her, and he is quoted as saying at the time, she was the greatest natural actress of her time. This is a still from the film. Well, things did not go so well for Una at United Artists because she was really modeling her career off Lillian Gish, very dramatic, and she really wasn't getting anywhere. And someone over at Fox remembered her from Coquette, and they said, "You know, we've got this great part for you. Your contract at United Artists is over. Why don't you come over to the Fox lot and do a film? And you can kind of play up your southernness. It's kind of a kooky role, but we remember you from Coquette, and you can do this." She did it, and she was an absolute success. So she had found her niche, as it is. It wasn't doing dramatic films, it was doing comedy. And you can see Una there with Edmund Lowe. And does anyone know who that is in the far right? It's kind of hard to see. Anyone? That's Jeanette MacDonald. It's an interesting film role for Jeanette MacDonald because she doesn't sing one note in this film. In an existing letter in an archive, demonstrates her unhappiness with the film. She wasn't happy. She didn't have her cinematographer because she was really the star of the film. And she's like, this film is, I don't really feel like it's my own. Well, she was right because Una and Roland Young got the best reviews and they stole the film out from under her. So Una definitely had found her niche. Well, Una continued at Fox for another year, but they also didn't know what to do with her. And it was time for her to renew her contract, and it was already negotiated that she would have a salary increase. They reneged on the salary increase, and she was very unhappy because she had done like 7 or 8 films that year. And they're like, well, you know, it's better being on the inside than the outside looking in. And she's like, okay. So MGM called for a loan out at their studio, and she went and she got the part in Private Lives that Noel Coward had made popular on Broadway. And MGM loved her, and they signed her to a 7-year contract. And a 7-year contract was the typical contract during the studio days. And this was quite a coup for Una because MGM was the best, the most prestigious. Everyone wanted to be at MGM. They had a lot of money behind their productions. Warner Brothers, kind of the opposite spectrum, they did the real hard, gritty crime stories, but they churned them out very quickly. It was all beauty and opulence and sophistication to MGM. So she was just delighted to have gotten that great contract. And remember, this is during the Great Depression. So to have a 7-year contract at a studio like MGM was just manna from heaven. That is her husband on the left, Ronald Burla. He was an aviation engineer. And they got married on the very first of 1932, making them the first Hollywood couple of 1932. And that's Dr. Marcus Welby in the background, as you can see. Robert Young. She was good friends with so many people in Hollywood. That's Robert Young and his wife sitting at the table with them. I want to play a clip to let you kind of see Una in action. That's Loretta Young playing the piano. Here comes Una as Dixie Dare, known for her cartwheels. Thank you.
maybe you'd better not do those cartwheels. I need to have you get any busier. How'd you happen to sign a deputy like this Dixie Dare?
Well, she seemed to be pretty good when I sign her up.
She may be good, but if she can do a cartwheel, I'll take a bath at Macy's window.
All right, as I mentioned before, comedy was her forte, and her specialty was playing the wisecracking best friend. This time she was Loretta Young's best friend. Sometimes she played gold diggers as well. What's interesting about this, and I want you to see it not only because it's funny, but you know, Una did probably a dozen high kicks, and she did have some dancing background. When I tell you what one critic said about this performance, he did not focus on Una's performance. He said she was fat. So the reason I'm bringing that up is because this obsession with being extremely thin, svelte, whatever you want to call it, is nothing new. He said she was overweight. So you can kind of see where all that began. It wasn't recently. All right, Una had many friends in Hollywood, as I mentioned before, Lillian Gish, Helen Hayes. One of her very best friends was Madge Evans. Unless you're a really big aficionado of the Golden Age, you may not know her, but she was a very, very competent and very pleasing actress to watch. On the left is the infamous Jean Harlow, and that's a scene with Jean on the right in Red-Headed Woman. Jean Harlow, Una loved her, and she was also universally beloved by everyone in Hollywood. Of all the people in the world, the two people who made more Jean Harlow films were Mae Robson, the elderly character actress, and Una Merkel. They both made 4 films with Jean Harlow. So Una's roles were more prominent than that of Mae Robson. So someone could argue that the person who really worked with Jean Harlow the most in films was Una Merkel. And they were very good friends, and Jean Harlow's death absolutely devastated Una, as it did the whole Hollywood community. And I have a whole chapter in the book about Jean Harlow, and you would never think that those two women were anything alike, but I talk about all the many similarities between them. Yes, superficially they were both blonde. They both loved to read, especially mystery novels. They adored dogs. They both had an inferiority complex like you wouldn't believe. Yes, Jean Harlow did. She did not believe in herself. Family was extremely important to them, and some people would argue to their detriment. Una Merkel never lived away from her parents, even when she was married. Jean Harlow didn't either, except for a couple months. So you can say they were unusually close to their parents. There were some father issues. Jean Harlow's father left the family when she was quite young, and as I mentioned before, Arno was always on the road with another business venture. So they were actually two peas in a pod. They were very, very similar in many respects. All right, perhaps arguably Una's most famous role was the one she did at Universal in 1939. Unfortunately, MGM did not renew Una's contract. She was very upset by that because she had worked so hard for them. In 1933, she appeared in 13 films alone. So remember, this was a 6-day week. They had Sundays off, but if they needed to do retakes, you had to go back on Sunday. So she was very upset. The MGM felt that they had kind of exhausted their Daffy Southern characters. I mean, Una had grown tired of those, and she wanted to be more known for more dramatic roles. She wanted to try something new. So they ended her contract, where it expired. They did not renew it. So she was looking for work, and she got this role in Destry Rides Again, where she gets embroiled in a 2-minute, no holds barred cat fight with Marlene Dietrich, and this kind of cemented her cinematic fame. So we're going to play this one for you. And I'll talk briefly about this scene.
Is it number 8?
I think it's at the bottom again. Yeah, there you go. Thank you. Sorry. All right, that lasted 2 minutes, and it seems when you watch it like it's lasting forever. Well, the stunt ladies were supposed to do this scene, and Dietrich's like, that ain't gonna happen. She's like, that's not gonna look very realistic. So right before they started shooting, she said, we're going to do it, Yuna. Yuna's like, what? She's like, yeah, we're gonna do them. And she's like, let me tell you what, I'm going to kick you, I'm going to punch you, I'm going to pull your hair, I'm going to make it look very realistic, so you better fight back, or you're going to find yourself at the losing end of this. So, unbeknownst to Yuna, this happened like this, and when they finished, the crew erupted into thunderous applause, because they realized this is kind of off the cuff, but they both were worse for wear, that's for sure. Yuna reported that those high-heeled shoes that she removed in one scene, Marlena stepped on her toe, and her toenail came off, and it never grew back. Also, they both sustained so many bruises that Yuna's physician kept her in the hospital for 3 days because he was worried about internal injuries. But despite all that, it made for great cinematic viewing, and for generations, people would watch this scene to get some pointers on how to stage a fight scene. But Yuna was asked about Deidre, and she's like, oh, she's like, she was a sweet girl. There's another steal from it. Oh, I have so many stories to tell you, and I see that I'm running a little bit short on time, so I'm going to speed this up a little bit, because I haven't even gotten through pretty much half of Yuna's life. But she was an independent agent now, free agent. She was not connected with a studio. So she was able to pick roles of her choosing, and she was delighted to be in the bank dick with W.C. Fields. W.C. Fields, as you know, had a reputation for hitting the bottle a little bit now and then. And sure enough, on one of the very first days of filming, he came to the set inebriated. And he had some scenes with Yuna, and she played his daughter in this film. And in between takes, he's like, I'm really sorry, because he knew his breath reeked of alcohol. And she said, on you, sir, it's like Chanel number 5. And he's like, kid, you're in. And he loved her from that moment on. And he taught her juggling in between takes and everything. They got along great. This is a film from the 40s. And I put this in here because I want you to see how Yuna is changing her look. She was kind of that sassy, wisecracking blonde in the 30s. This is the 40s. So she's getting older. So they played around with her hair color and hairstyles. And this is a rather elegant shot of her in Edmund Lowe. You probably remember him from a previous still. The 40s happened to be probably the low point of Yuna's life, both professionally and personally. The one happy note was her time entertaining the troops during World War II. And she and Gary Cooper, as you can see, the second from the left, and Phyllis Brooks is the third from the right. And there was a musician who accompanied them. They went to Australia and New Guinea to entertain the troops, and it really was a bright light in the 40s, because the 40s were definitely very difficult for Yuna. In fact, very tragic for her. But while on tour, she had the time of her life. Gary Cooper had a little more trouble than Yuna because he was not used to the stage. They did skits and they told jokes and they sang, but he didn't have Yuna's theatrical background. So without a script, because remember, he was a movie star, he really struggled. So she kind of had to kind of pull him through some of the scenes. Well, he finally found something that really resonated with the troops, and that was Lou Gehrig's Yankee Stadium speech, which he had done in Pride of the Yankees a year before. This is 1943. So he would recite that speech, and the soldiers would kind of look at him in revered silence, and some of them would weep. So it was his way of kind of reaching out to them. And Yuna would sing songs from Oklahoma and tell jokes, but it was a very moving experience for everyone involved. Difficult, they were within a half a mile of enemy fire. They had to deal with swarming insects, electrical outages, not very, very good venues to perform. The lights they used sometimes made the temperatures more than 130 degrees on stage. So it was very difficult, but as I mentioned, Yuna had the time of her life. There's Yuna's mother, Bessie. This is probably something else for you to read in the book, but something very tragic happens to her mother, and Yuna almost dies during the same event. And in some respects, Yuna never really fully recovers from that tragic moment. In addition to almost dying, she sank into a terrible depression, had a nervous breakdown, her career was virtually over. But in the 50s, like a phoenix rising from the ashes, she resumed her career, and she made a nice transition to companions, mothers, elderly aunts. Here she's playing Debbie Reynolds' mother. That's Debbie Reynolds there on the right. Alan Jocelyn seated. Donald O'Connor. And Richard Anderson, remember Oscar from the Bionic Man, the $6 million man, and the Bionic Woman. Richard Anderson is still alive and with us. He's way up there, and he was very nice to me and sent me a nice response to my inquiry about Una, whom he said was extremely professional. Debbie Reynolds, I wrote a couple times and never got a response, but right before the book went to press, she wrote a book about Hollywood mothers, and I was able to glean a great quote from Debbie for my book, and she said, "Of all my film mothers, the sweetest and the most wonderful was Una Merkel." So I'm going to go quickly here because I don't have much time. This is The Kentuckian. So Una made a rare venture back home to film this, and Burt Lancaster hand chose her for this part because she had done a great favor for Paramount a couple years earlier and helped him out, so he wanted to repay the favor. Una came back, and this film was filmed in London, Kentucky, in Owensboro, and Una got virtually no fanfare whatsoever. I couldn't find one interview with her during her return. There was only one photograph that I could find in the newspaper. So she really, it was kind of sad to me that she really wasn't embraced as a big star. There was virtually nothing I could find about her reception by her native Kentuckians. The Ponder Heart, Una won a Tony Award for this play in 1956. It was an adaptation of Eudora Welty's novella. And she became good friends with Eudora Welty. And the lady sitting in the car with Una was Sarah Marshall. You may remember Herbert Marshall from the 1930s and 40s, a famous actor. It was his daughter. And she wrote me a beautiful four-page letter talking about her experience with Una. And Sarah really wanted to read this book so badly because she said, "Una would not believe that you wrote this book." She never really thought anyone would really care that much to write a book like that, so this would be totally unexpected. But unfortunately, Sarah succumbed to cancer and was not able to read the book. Jackie Gleason became a huge friend in the 50s when she was in a musical with him, Take Me Along. I'll talk briefly about him in a second. Una Merkel got her star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in 1916. Just a real quick story about this, I have to tell you this. I was so excited to go to California. I went there twice to do research, twice to the Academy Awards Library, to USC, to UCLA, and I absolutely wanted to see the star. I wanted to touch the star. Some people clean the stars and all that. Anyway, so I kind of looked on Google Maps to see where the star approximately was, so my wife Valerie and I took the subway, and we got off at the nearest subway stop to where I thought the star was. And you have to understand, there are thousands of these stars, and they go in both directions for miles. I mean, I had the number memorized, I'm forgetting right now, but it was, I want to say 7,500 stars. So I told Val, I said, "You know, I don't know if we're going to find this star. It may take us a while to find it. So let's just be patient." She's like, "Okay, that's fine. We have all day." So we got off the subway and we walked towards the sidewalk where the stars were, and the very first star I saw was Una Merkel's. So I think that was her just smiling down at me saying, "Thank you, Sonny, for the book." Well, now this is maybe Una's other famous role that you may know her from. This is from the original Parent Trap. And she played Verbena, the housekeeper in California, who is on to Haley and her sister, Susan and Sharon. Now, just I wrote to Haley. Haley did not respond to me, but there was a young lady who was in some of the shots with Haley. They used trick photography to reproduce the twins. But for some of the shots, they could not use trick photography, so they had to have someone off of whom Haley could react. I tracked that lady down, and she gave me a great interview. She's like, "I do not want to be called an understudy. I do not want to be called a body double. I do not want to be called," I'm like, "you know, a stand-in." I'm like, "What do I call you?" She's like, "Well, you'll figure that out." But she's like, "I just don't want to be referred to as any of those terms." She's like, I was none of those. And she proceeded to explain the differences to me. Her name was Susan Henning. She's now married Shuta. And also a very emotional time. You get to know these people and it just strikes chords within you. She also was suffering from cancer. But she was gracious enough, even when she wasn't feeling well, to give me a beautiful quote from the book. It was just so poignant and so heart-wrenching when I read when I copied it down. It was a phone interview. But she's like, you know, I had a brief fling with Elvis Presley. I'm like, oh, really? She's like, can I send you the book? I'm like, sure. So she sent me the book, and they were only together about 2 or 3 months, but it's a pictorial of them together, and she wrote a beautiful little thing in the front, and she's like, can I have one of your books? I'm like, sure. Una Merkel was nominated for an Academy Award for this movie, that's Summer and Smoke, Tennessee Williams. She didn't win, unfortunately. Rita Moreno won for West Side Story. But a fascinating portrait, not a comedic role at all. She plays a spinster. Well, no, she's not a spinster, she's married. But she has some mental health issues, is a nice way of putting it. A really fantastic role for Una. Shows her acting chops. Her with Elvis Presley, she finished her career with Elvis in one of his films. Not a very good film. His films are not known for they're fun, but they're not like cinematic history or anything. But she, of course, thought the world of him. Her very last role, totally, was in the I Spy series with Bill Cosby and Robert Culp. And I was so fortunate because Robert Culp wrote this particular episode that she was in, and he did a commentary on the DVD. It's only like one or two shows out of the whole slew of seasons that it was on where there was a commentary track. So I was so stoked to listen to that, because he said, you know, I didn't want Una Merkel for this role. I wanted Beulah Bondi, and I didn't want Will Gear for it. I wanted Walter Brennan. He's like, but Una blew me away. And it was a beautiful quote. He said, she just brought tears in my eyes. So he was very impressed. It's a very difficult role. She plays his mother, and she and her husband are being threatened by assassins. So fascinating episode. But that was the end of her career. And as she said, I kind of tied it up with a blue ribbon. So that was it for her. You'll have to read the book to find out about her later years, which are very, very interesting due to what I learned from Richard Lamparsky. But Una passed away in 1986, and there were three people at her funeral. Her funeral was in outside of Covington. She received 50 red carnations with baby's breath from Jackie Gleason, and she received no other flowers. There were no prayers, nothing. And one of the persons who attended the funeral was just the pastor of her church. So really only two people attended, Clyde Day, that you saw earlier, and a friend. And I just thought that was so incredibly sad, this woman who touched millions of lives. There were two people at her funeral, and only one person sent flowers. And there was not even a tombstone. So a fan collected money by contacting some of her former colleagues, and they were able to raise enough money to get her a tombstone. And that picture's in the book, too. I tried to only show you pictures that were not in the book tonight, so if you want to look at the book, you'll see over 100 different pictures. But Una was honored with a historical marker in Goble Park there in Covington. It's a beautiful place, beautiful marker, marred by the fact they say she was in 66 motion pictures when it was over 100, when you count her lost silent films. So I thought that was, of course, that was before the internet, but kind of a break on that. But they didn't count very well for that. Just a few weeks ago, they unveiled a new Una Merkel mural downtown in Covington, and I heard about it, and I wrote to one of the people who was instrumental in getting this done and said, I've got to be there. You know, I wrote a book on Una Merkel, can I please come? He's like, absolutely. So I came, and that's a picture of me in front of the mural. And incidentally, Una has been celebrated a couple times on Turner Classic Movies for her birthday, December the 10th. And they had a whole marathon of her films for those 2 different years they celebrated her. So she's still very much remembered. If you remember from the audio, she's like, it's so nice to be remembered. And she certainly is remembered and holds a special place in many fans' heart. And that's just a concluding shot of her. Well, that is the conclusion of my presentation. I want to thank you so much for your attention. I'm happy to field any questions if you have any. Anybody have any questions?
The mural was it down by the water?
Oh, I'm sorry. Why?
The mural that you were in front of, is that down by the flood water?
The mural is actually not down by the water. It's on a street quite a bit, a few streets inward. It's in an arcade. So what's wonderful about that, Mike, is that it'll be protected from the elements. They wanted to put the mural on an old hotel building. But of course, that would have been exposed to the elements, and it would, you know, eventually be ruined, or they'd have to redo it. So it's kind of in an arcade on an interior street downtown. Mm-hmm. Sorry, there was another question.
I'm sorry, I haven't read your book yet, Tom. But did she have any children?
Una did not have any children. I didn't tell you about her marriage. Her marriage ended after 15 years, and she attributed the dissolution of the marriage to the fact that her husband was gone so much due to his responsibilities during the war that they just kind of lost touch and kind of fell out. Yeah. But as far as I know, no close living relatives at all still alive. But someone else in the back. Thank Jeannie? You. Thank you, Jeannie, for the question. No, she has not, although she did win, I can't remember the exact organization, it's in the book. In the 70s, she was celebrated at this one festival, and she was given like an honorary award. But as far as I know, she has not, except for, of course, you know, the star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, which is actually very prestigious. Many people want to be on that today, and it's very political. You have to have a lot of pull, and there's a long waiting list. So I think it was kind of a coup that she got to be a part of that. But no, as far as I know, she was an official member of the Academy after she was nominated, that she was inducted as an official member. So for a couple years, though, she did vote on the best picture and all that. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I know she took an overdose at one point. Was that related to her mother's death or to her divorce or just things in general?
All right. He was asking about her overdose, and I'm glad you asked me that question. And he was asking me, was the overdose connected with her mother or separately? The thing about the overdose is that it was not connected with her mother. So I don't want to give too much away in case you want to read the book, spoilers. But it was not connected with her mother. There is a huge question as to whether Una even had an overdose or did an overdose. They found her lying on the floor. They rushed her to the hospital. She had been ill, and she was very upset when she recovered that people thought she had tried to end her life. This was in 1952. And she's like, I did not try to take my own life. I did not do an overdose. I was ill. I was not feeling well. I grabbed the wrong bottle, and that's the true story. The problem with Una's account of what happened was that it almost happened 7 years to the day after her mother's death. So some people think that perhaps she wasn't being really totally honest with the public. She may have been distraught or just upset about thinking about the anniversary of her mother's death and took an overdose. And perhaps later on she felt maybe a little ashamed or upset about what she'd done and tried to smooth it over. So there's no clear answer to that. I'm surprised that she would have tried to take her life because her career was on the upswing. She was doing quite well. Her father was still alive. He didn't die until 1969. She adored him. Eventually he did settle back in town with her and live with her for the rest of his life. And I don't think she would have ever wanted to put him through what she had been put through and what he had been put through with her mother's death. So that's an unanswered question. It's kind of, all biographers have those type of things. You just never can get to the bottom of certain really interesting issues, and that's one. But thank you for the good question. Any other questions?
What sort of salary did she make?
Well, you remember she left Fox because they refused to renew her contract when it came up for renewal with the salary increase. At MGM, she made a very good salary. It was reported in 1937 or 1938, I can't remember, that she was making $37,000. And when you think, during the Depression in 1937, I never could find a way of, I know people can do it, but I always want to know what would that be today. But you can imagine, $37,000, people don't make that, some people don't make that now. So, unfortunately, but during the Depression, 1937, that was a really huge income. So the thing about the studios is that if they didn't find films for you, you were still paid. You were still paid. So near the end of her contract, when they didn't find film roles for her, she was still paid. But the professional she was very unhappy because she was sitting there idle. And she's like, you know, I'm getting paid. I want to work. You know, so that was kind of a bone of contention that may have led, that may have hastened her departure from MGM because they were paying out a huge salary and not finding proper roles for her.
One more question back here.
Sean, I'll put you on the spot. If you had to recommend one film for us to watch of hers, which would it be?
The film that I would recommend is probably not one of her well-known films at all. It's called Day of Reckoning with her friend Madge Evans and Richard Dix. Richard Dix was a really popular star in the 30s at RKO. It was his one picture at MGM. And Una is wonderful in the film. She plays a housekeeper who takes over. She really becomes a surrogate parent to the children after Richard Dix and Madge Evans, after they get into some trouble. And it allows her to be funny, it allows her to be poignant. Spanky McFarlane from Our Gang is in there. It's just a really interesting film where she really can show a large range of her talent. And the critics all said she stole the film. And she did. She's who you remember. She's in the opening scene, she's in the concluding scene, and she just really dominates the film, even though she was, I think, third or fourth billed in that film. So Day of Reckoning. And I think it has been released on DVD. So.
Well, on that note, I'm going to bring this to a conclusion.
Thank you all so much. As Una would say, bless your heart.